Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly and Susan Shand. Later, Pete Musto brings us this week's science report. We end our program with the next episode of our history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
Money from casinos has lifted many Native American tribal economies and made some tribes rich. Take the Shakopee Midwaukton in the state of Minnesota, for example. Its gaming operations earn tribe members $1 million a year. But the road to casino riches can be rocky, as the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe of Massachusetts has discovered. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is an agency of the United States government. In 2007, the Bureau recognized that the Mashpee had operated as a community since colonial times. It found that 97% of Mashpee members are related to the historic tribe. In 2015, the agency placed about 130 hectares of land in trust as the Mashpee's reservation. The term in trust means someone or something, in this case the federal government, guarantees and protects the property for the tribe. 60 hectares of the land were in the Massachusetts town of Mashpee. The other 70 hectares were about 56 kilometers away from Mashpee, in the town of Taunton. This was one-tenth of one-third of our total tribe base, said Cedric Cromwell, the tribe's chairman. Cromwell told VOA his people were among the first to welcome English settlers to what became Plymouth, Massachusetts. He said, the tribe controlled 36,000 square kilometers of land in the 17th century. For years, the Mashpee had wanted to build a $1 billion casino in Taunton and agreed to pay the state 17% of all its earnings. The tribe made its offer on the condition that no other casinos be built in the area. The town approved their plan, and the Mashpee borrowed money to start building the casino. But the tribe had competition. In early 2013, a Chicago developer made an offer to Massachusetts state officials. The developer wanted to build a $1 billion casino resort just 24 kilometers away from the Mashpee Casino. Weeks before the Mashpee were ready to start work on the casino, town people from Taunton brought legal action against the federal government. They said the Mashpee were not really Indian, and they should not be given land. That case was partly financed by the Chicago developer. Even after the state rejected the developer's proposal, a U.S. district judge ruled against the Mashpee. The ruling required the Bureau of Indian Affairs to reconsider the issue. Since then, the tribe has been in limbo. It has halted work on the casino project and is now hundreds of millions in debt and no earnings. Cedric Cromwell believes the case was driven by race. The claimant said, "We're all for a casino in Taunton, but we don't want an Indian casino," he said. Adam Bond, the lawyer who represented the lead plaintiff, denied that race was a consideration. Does Mr. Cromwell believe that Judge Young is racist because he read the law and gave a correct reading of that law? Bond wrote in an email to VOA. He called the case a clean and fair fight. The Bureau of Indian Affairs reports to the U.S. Department of the Interior. The Interior Department said it would make a decision about the future of the Mashpee's reservation by June 2017. Yet, no decision has been made. It may be a long time in coming, suggests Brian Newland, a Michigan lawyer who specializes in Indian gaming law. He is an Ojibwe citizen of the Bay Mills Indian community. Newland said, the Trump administration approved a rule governing any request to put land into trust outside existing reservations. It says, those requests should be decided by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. This creates a bottleneck, he said, adding that there are not enough people working at the Bureau's headquarters to study the requests and make decisions. In addition, 15 months into the Trump administration, the Interior Department has yet to appoint an Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. Newland said, the department is developing policies about Native Americans without appointing Indian Affairs policymakers. He wonders who is actually responsible for decisions. Cromwell says, the Trump administration is working to detribalize and take Mashpee's land out of trust. A Bureau of Indian Affairs spokesperson told VOA she is unable to comment on the case while it is being considered in court. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Scientists in developing nations are considering ways to limit the effects of climate change on Earth. These scientists plan to explore one possibility: controlling or restricting sunshine levels. They want to see if use of a man-made chemical to block sunlight would be less risky than a rise in surface temperatures. This area of study is called solar geoengineering. Researchers believe that using the right chemical or chemicals might produce the same effect in Earth's atmosphere as a big volcanic explosion. They think it could cool surface temperatures by hiding the sun with a cloud of ash. Currently, the solar geoengineering is being studied mainly in industrial nations and by universities such as Harvard and Oxford. 12 scientists from developing countries say poor people are most likely to be affected by climate change, and they think the poor should be more involved. Developing countries must lead on solar geoengineering research, they said. Nature magazine published a commentary written by the scientists. They are from countries such as Bangladesh, Brazil, China, Ethiopia, India, Jamaica, and Thailand. Atiq Rahman, the lead writer, is head of the Bangladesh Center for Advanced Studies. He said the idea of solar geoengineering is unusual, but slowly growing in popularity in the world of research. He spoke by telephone with the Reuters news agency. A new $400,000 research project may prove helpful to solar geoengineering studies. It has urged scientists to request financing for their studies. The project is called the Solar Radiation Management Governance Initiative. It receives help from the Open Philanthropy Project, a group supported by Dustin Moskovitz, a co-founder of Facebook, and his wife, Carrie Tuna, the scientists wrote. The project could help scientists in developing nations study the effects of solar geoengineering on floods and dry weather, said Andy Parker, a project director of the SRMGI. Rahman said he and the other scientists were not saying that geoengineering would work. Among the ideas, airplanes might release shiny sulfur particles high in the Earth's atmosphere. It is too early to know what its effects would be. It could be very helpful or very harmful, the 12 specialists wrote, adding that many are against the idea. A group of United Nations climate experts also have questions about solar geoengineering and its effectiveness in fighting climate change. Their comments appear in a leaked copy of a report about climate change set for release in October. Rahman noted that most developed nations have not kept their promises to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Studies have linked those gases, such as carbon dioxide, to rising temperatures. For that reason, Rahman said, the other possible ways to limit warming must be explored. The world is set for a warming of 3 degrees Celsius, he said, far above a goal of keeping a rise in temperatures well below 2 Celsius. That target was set under the 2015 Paris Agreement. I'm Susan Chan.
Japanese engineer Masaaki Nagumo had always dreamed of operating a robot from Mobile Suit Gundam. That is the name of a popular Japanese animation television series. It was Nagumo's favorite show when he was a child. The series features huge, human-controlled machines in battle. Now, Nagumo has made the show come to life. He has built a large robot inspired by the machines. The robot is called LW Mononofu. The farming machinery company Sakakibara Kikai developed it. The robot is 8.5 meters tall, has 2 legs, and weighs more than 7 metric tons. It has a seating area with monitors and devices for the pilot to be able to control the robot's arms and legs. The 44-year-old Nagumo spoke to the Reuters news agency about the popularity of the Mobile Suit Gundam series. It inspired movies, manga, video games, and more. And so, he suggested the robot could be popular as well. I think this can be turned into a business opportunity, Nagumo said. Sakakibara Kikai develops robots and entertainment machines in addition to its main agriculture equipment business. For a rate of about $930 an hour, people can rent the machines for children's birthday parties and other events, Nagumo said. The company has created robots of all sizes. There is the almost 3.5 meter tall land walker, the smaller kids walker Cyclops, and the mech boxer boxing machine. But the Mononofu stands above them all. It also does more complex movements. It can move its fingers and turn its upper body and walk forward and backward. However, it moves very slowly, at a speed of less than 1 kilometer per hour. Although it may be slow, the Mononofu is very powerful. The bazooka-like air gun on its right arm shoots balls of soft material at 140 kilometers per hour. As an anime-inspired robot that one can ride, I think this is the biggest in the world, Nagumo said. But Mononofu might be a bit too large. It is unable to leave the factory without being taken apart because it was built taller than the entrance. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1880, President Rutherford Hayes completed 4 successful years in the White House. He did not want to serve another term. Hayes was a Republican. His party had great hopes of electing another Republican in the election of 1880. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe report on that election.
Many Republicans wanted to nominate former President Ulysses Grant. Grant had been out of office 4 years. People seemed to have forgotten the political problems that shook his administration. Other Republicans supported the powerful party leader, Senator James Blaine. A third candidate was John Sherman, the Secretary of the Treasury. The Republicans had great difficulty choosing among Grant, Blaine, and Sherman. At their national convention, Republican delegates voted again and again. None of the three men received a majority.
The delegates voted 10 times, 20 times, 30 times. Finally, on the 34th ballot, 17 of the delegates voted for a compromise candidate. He was James Garfield, a Republican leader in Congress. Soon, both Sherman and Blaine asked all of their delegates to vote for Garfield. The compromise candidate won the nomination. James Garfield offered the vice presidential nomination to Chester Arthur of New York. Arthur's honesty had been questioned when President Hayes removed him as collector of taxes for the port of New York. But a powerful party leader there supported him. So delegates gave Arthur the vice presidential nomination to strengthen party unity.
The Democratic Party chose for its presidential candidate a hero of the Civil War, General Winfield Scott Hancock of Pennsylvania. The election campaign of 1880 was not exciting. Democrats charged that Republicans were dishonest. Republicans charged that a Democrat in the White House would make the South too powerful. Many people at that time still hated the South for starting the Civil War. They wanted to keep Southern states weak. 9 million people voted in the election. James Garfield won. He got only 10,000 more popular votes than Winfield Scott Hancock, but he got a majority of votes in the Electoral College. Garfield won 214 electoral votes. Hancock got 155.
The new president was 49 years old. He had served in the House of Representatives for 17 years. He had been a teacher, a college president, and a general in the Union Army during the Civil War. James Garfield became president of the United States on March 4th, 1881. His choices for a cabinet immediately reopened the conflicts that had appeared during the party convention.
The Republican Party had two powerful leaders. One was Senator Roscoe Conkling. The other was Senator James Blaine. Garfield won Blaine's support by naming him Secretary of State. He lost Conkling's support by refusing to name one of Conkling's supporters Secretary of the Treasury. Garfield denied he had promised anything to Conkling. Then he made Conkling even angrier by appointing one of Conkling's political enemies collector of taxes for the Port of New York. That was the most important federal job in Conkling's home state. Conkling refused to accept the appointment. He began a struggle in the Senate to block it.
Conkling charged that President Garfield had failed to observe the policy of senatorial courtesy. Traditionally, the president does not fill federal jobs in a state until he discusses them with the senators from that state. This long-time policy gave senators firm control over local federal jobs. They were quick to attack any changes in the method. But many senators were angry at Conkling. They did not like the way he gave orders to everyone. They did not like the way he threatened his opponents. They did not want to support him on this issue.
After several weeks, it became clear that the Senate would approve President Garfield's choice for the tax collector's job. Conkling decided to resign in protest. He would ask the New York legislature to show its support by electing him again to the Senate. Before this could happen, something very unexpected took place. It happened in the train station in Washington, D.C. on July 2nd, 1881. A man ran up to President Garfield, pulled out a gun, and fired twice. One bullet cut Garfield's arm. The other went into his back.
The assassin was Charles Guiteau. When he fired the gun, he shouted that he supported Roscoe Conkling's political machine. Charles Guiteau was insane. He believed God had ordered him to kill the president. But the words he shouted caused many people to wonder if others might be involved. After all, the vice president, Chester Arthur, supported Roscoe Conkling too. If James Garfield died, Chester Arthur would become president. History has provided no evidence that Roscoe Conkling, Chester Arthur, or any other political leader had a part in the shooting. Guiteau is believed to have acted on his own. Yet the situation did cause a great deal of tension while the nation waited to see if Garfield would survive.
The president was carried to the White House. A doctor tried to remove the bullet from his back. He could not find it. Days passed. The president's condition changed from day to day. Doctors pushed their instruments into the wound as they continued to look for the bullet. The wound became infected. Garfield grew worse. Then he grew better. He asked to be taken to the seashore. 2 months later, the doctors warned the cabinet and Vice President Arthur that Garfield was dying. The end finally came on September 19, 1881. The president's body was taken back to Washington. Memorial services were held there. And then the body was taken to his home state of Ohio for burial.
Not until after Garfield's death did doctors find the bullet that killed him. It lay only a few centimeters from the wound. Tissue had grown around it. The bullet itself would not have killed the president. What killed him was the effort made by doctors to find the bullet. Their instruments had spread infection throughout his body. James Garfield had been president for 6 months. He was the second American president to be assassinated. The first, Abraham Lincoln, had been shot just 16 years before.
The man who shot James Garfield, Charles Guiteau, was tried by a court in Washington. He was found guilty of murder. Like those found guilty of plotting to kill Abraham Lincoln, he was hanged. Vice President Chester Arthur was in New York when he received news of President Garfield's death. He quickly sent for a judge to give him the oath of office as president. Arthur was in his early 50s. He would serve one term as leader of the United States.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for more news and information from around the world. Thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Thompson.